This week on Lunchbox Envy, Pliny the Elder recommended vulture lungs and bat's blood.
Victorian sex shop sold potions made from dried blister beetles.
And in the Amazon rainforest, you can slap up a bowl of piranha soup.
It's aphrodisiacs. Ah! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf Manu and chef and food writer Rosie.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good.
Great. So we're speaking to you today in Valentine's week, which is why we're talking about the science of food and love. Just off the top, we're going to be covering some quite sort of sexy content, I suppose. So if you're, you know, listening with kids, maybe listen first. I've certainly found some pretty spicy material.
Can I inquire politely, as I know we're all coupled up, what are on your Valentine's menus this year? Are you going out? Are you staying in? What are we having?
Nothing on the night because Emmy is working.
Okay.
Well. Obvi. But the next day, big group dinner at De Keys.
Group dinner. Ooh, this is an interesting turn of events.
A polycule Valentine's.
Yum. How about you guys?
Well, we traditionally go to the same Italian restaurant every year. But it's so far away and we've got a child now, so we're going to a local Italian restaurant.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that's really nice. Well, we started a new tradition after spending our honeymoon in Korea, which I have spoken about at length on this podcast. But basically, we ate this dish called dak hanmari, which is like a chicken stew where you cook it in front of you in a pot and you add lots of things as you're cooking. So you add noodles and rice cakes and potatoes, and it's spicy and it's hot, and we've got an induction stove, so we just set it up on the table. Aww. And we cook and chat
amazing.
To each other and eat our nice very spicy hot Korean
cock. Spicy hot cock
soup.
Aphrodisiacs, what are they? Has anyone managed to pin down the definition?
It is one of those things that is very subjective. I think every single food at one point or another has been called an aphrodisiac. So it's basically just something that is meant to get you in the mood for love, sex, and procreation. So it also has a lot to do with fertility as well, historically. Sometimes classified into two groups. So you have ones that are more to do with kind of like sensory experiences and the mind. So they're more psychological and like tactile.
Okay.
So the things that affect us from the kind of outside world. And there are internal ones, which are more to do with things that we eat and consume.
I mean, if I say aphrodisiac, what do you guys think of straight away?
Oysters.
Mm-hmm. Strawberries.
I think of chocolate.
Chocolate.
Mm-hmm. All three of those are famously, historically seen to be aphrodisiacs.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why for Valentine's Day, chocolates are one of the things you might give.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons particular foods were thought of as particularly sexy was because there was a theory in a Renaissance medical thought, which went that God, when he chucked Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden.
For being too sexy.
For being, very sexy. He was like, okay, guys, you're on your own. But I'm going to do you a little favor. All of the fruits and veg on this new planet of yours are shaped like the things they can heal.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different associations between particular foods and medicine. So say walnuts, they thought it would be good for your brain.
Walnuts look like brains,
walnuts
don't they?
Walnuts look like a brain. When you crack them open.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say something else then.
Beans, kind of kidney shaped. They're like beans, good for your kidneys. And then foods that were particularly phallic, shaped like a penis, or vulvic, shaped like a vulva, they're like, oh, obviously these things are going to help with your sex drive and like your fertility and all of this kind of sexy aphrodisiac-y stuff. So that's why we have foods like, say, the oyster.
Yeah.
Wait, yonic. What does that look like?
It's very yonic. It's got like a clitoris and everything.
I'm sorry, Jack, if you've never eaten an oyster before, then I feel sorry for your partner. Exactly. It's also the way you eat it.
What, like this? In one go.
Yeah. Ginseng is another famous aphrodisiac, and that is penis shaped as.
Is like, it? That's why the Wu-Tang Clan are always singing about sipping ginseng juice.
Is it?
Well, I assume. I don't know.
Yeah, well, actually, oysters, I read, one of the reasons why they're considered an aphrodisiac more recently, more mm-hmm. in more modern times. It's actually because they're rich in zinc, exactly. which is good for testosterone levels mm-hmm. and healthy sperm.
Because actually a lot of, obviously, history is quite male-dominated, so a lot of these historical aphrodisiacs will be much more based around, like, getting an erection or, like, having good sperm or lasting longer in the bedroom as a man.
Protestants, it was really interesting because part of their ideas about what, healthy sex lives and fertility was, is you have the idea of enjoying sex becoming really important. So the Catholics... not so keen on having loads of fun in the bedroom. The Protestants apparently were much more, okay, in order to get pregnant, it's quite important that both parties are having fun. And then you have like the boom in Europe of kind of female aphrodisiacs becoming more important.
Interesting.
Love that from the Protestants. Shout out the Protestants. new friends of the pod.
One of the things I loved about the history of aphrodisiacs is a lot of what we know about historical aphrodisiacs and the kind of classic tropes come from Arabic medicine and Arabic physicians, because they're really good at translating old texts from the Greek into different languages and made all of this kind of really, really old history accessible. One of the first people to use the term aphrodisiac was a Tunisian scholar called Constantinus Africanus, who translated the works of Galen and Hippocrates from Arabic into Latin. So he's one of the ones who helped proliferate all of this information about like sex and food and medicine.
Is it worth saying that aphrodisiac, the word, comes from the Greek goddess Aphrodite. Yeah.
Exactly. And venereal diseases named after the Roman goddess of love, Venus.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. Wow, they've really done Venus dirty there.
They have.
That seems a bit unfair. So in Greek mythology, Aphrodite was credited with planting the first pomegranate tree.
Aww.
And there is a big association with pomegranates and fertility because they have numerous seeds. They're very abundant. Mm-hmm. They're kind of yonic.
They're more like boobs.
They're quite booby, actually. Yeah. Yeah. But there is also a factual basis. Factual, she says with inverted commas. Pomegranates are really high in amino acids that enhance stamina. And they're also rich in iron, which is good for healthy eggs and ovulation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly.
I think ultimately the takeaway here is if you're eating your fruit and veg, you're healthy enough.
The baseline. Yeah. Being healthy is sexy.
Because actually, almost every food you can think of has been...
has something that's good for
you. Described as an aphrodisiac. It's quite a good selling point, especially to horny men in the Middle Ages. You can be like, buy my tincture. It will help you enjoy sex more. Mm. So apparently Brussels sprouts, spinach, cabbage, all meat, hot foods and rude-looking foods... Mm-hmm. They're all supposed to be aphrodisiac.
One of my favourite historical theories about sexuality and virility... farts.
Okay.
Going back to beans, there was an idea that erections were powered by wind. So
like a pneumatic.
Exactly. So if you ate more windy foods or windy meats, it would help you sustain an erection. So there was a botanist called John Gerard who recommended these kinds of foods, particularly mad or raging apples, which is what we now call aubergines.
Apples.
Yeah, those would make you gassy as well.
And now it's the emoji. It's come around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that has come right around.
It has come around full circle.
Yeah.
If anyone doesn't know, the aubergine emoji is now synonymous for penis. Because there is not a penis emoji.
There are going to be middle-aged people listening to this all around the country being like, oh my God, I didn't know this. I've been sending aubergines to my teenage daughters. Okay, it's time for Lunchbox number one. And this week, that is mine. Let me just fish it out.
Cool.
Ooh.
And so I've been sitting on this cake since the start of the podcast.
Oh, yeah,
that's like it. Oh, what was it? I would have eaten that.
It was a Victoria sponge.
Mm.
So I've brought you a cake that's been squashed by my own ass, and this is the end of a very long story of aphrodisiacs through history. So let's start back in ancient times. Han Dynasty China, we're talking 200 BCE to 200 Common Era. The imperial courts would plaster walls for their concubines with Sichuan peppercorns in.
Oh.
And part of the reason is that they smell nice and they're fragrant, but they're also a sign of fertility because they're actually berries that grow on the vine in pairs. So they look a bit like testicles. But they're also, they've got this amazing property whereby when you eat them, they trigger your pain and tactile receptors, as well as your taste. But it gives you a little buzz. And actually, it's a physical sensation as opposed to a taste. When you eat capsaicin, which is in chilies, you're being tricked into thinking it's hot.
Yeah,
they're like nature's popping candy.
Absolutely. And I brought some with me if you want to try. And mine's sort of a secondary lunchbox.
Delicious.
Nice. Have you sat on these as well?
I haven't sat on these, no.
They're not
so much more perfumed.
In a couple of minutes, you should feel a sort of numbing sensation, and the frequency is 50 hertz. Actually, they tested this by how they got people to eat Sichuan peppercorns and then hold tuning forks that were like at various frequencies. And then they put them to their lips and they tried to sort of match it up. And they found out it's 50 hertz. So your lips will start vibrating at 50 times a second.
They're very salty, your ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they might be salted, these ones. But anyway, so the emperors would literally put these into the mortar they would make the walls with and then have sex in that room.
And everything was vibrating.
And everything was vibrating. Well, there's no record of them using the actual Sichuan peppercorns in sex, but I don't know, maybe give it a go.
I think that would be a bad idea. Yeah. That would hurt. That would be painful.
Where are you putting them?
Where aren't you putting them? Oh, I'm getting a little bit of numbing.
So anyway, back in ancient times, have you come across the ancient Greek bread dildo?
Not yet.
And by come across, I mean discover. Ancient Greeks used to occasionally use bread for dildos.
Wow.
Olis bokolix. So it's a portmanteau of ancient Greek. The bread is kolix and dildo is olisbos.
Oh, they had a word for dildo in ancient Greece.
They did indeed.
Of course they did.
They were the sexiest of the ancients, weren't they? So
we've only found it once in the literature. It's called a hapax legomenon. So it may have been like a slang term. But there are three separate decorated urns which show dildo-shaped loaves of bread. There's one in the Petit Palais in Paris, and there's one in the British Museum. And the other one, I don't know where it is, but go on.
Hands up.
Hands up. A baguette's not dildo shaped anyway.
Well, they're phallic.
Yeah.
But they, I think you, no offense, struggle to get a baguette right now.
Well, they were lubricated with olive oil, which might help, but I agree about the girth. I'm speaking as a dildo amateur. No, wait.
No shame on you if you were not an amateur.
No, I mean, but
this is a sex positive podcast.
Absolutely.
Do you know anything about the bake on this bread? Like, are we talking crispy, crusty?
You don't want a crunchy as bad. You don't want crunchy for
this. But you also don't want something
soft.
You don't want soft.
No, you want when it's like nearly lacquered, like super shiny.
Yes,
I think.
Tell you what, gives you a new perspective on a yeast infection. Am I right?
I suspect it was a bit more like pasta,
as uncooked in like pasta,
wheat flour mixed with water made into a shape.
Yes,
you don't want hard spaghetti up in you.
Some people
again,
do.
Again, it depends on your taste.
Let's reflect. What do we think the best pasta shape for a dildo
that is a great
would
question.
Be?
I think the rigatoni actually would work, and it could work for the penis
what
as well.
What about the like little macaroni one that's shaped like a smile, but really big?
Are you like a curved dildo is what I'm getting from that.
What about you?
I find it funny that neither of you said penne.
which almost means
that's
penis.
That's the spiky one.
That's true. Chocolate. Historically, he has been an aphrodisiac. And I think this probably comes from when the conquistadors came and decimated Central America. They came across Montezuma II, the leader of the Aztecs. And I think we mentioned in the chocolate episode, he was surrounded by sexy women. And he was also drinking chocolate. So the simple Spanish were like, oh, chocolate equals sexual performance. And obviously, I was exotic. I think a lot of exotic things become aphrodisiacs because they're kind of untested. And so you can kind of sell it as snake oil.
Yeah, things that are rare and expensive.
Exactly.
Ambergris,
yeah.
Another one, which is an excretion of a sperm whale. It's a waxy substance that they use to coat the spikier parts of the animals they're eating. So if there's lots of little bones or sharp,
That's clever.
This comes out either end of them, so they could poop or vomit it out. But it's a big chunk of fat and it has a really, really strong smell, which is supposed to be kind of like musky or marine-y. Some people say it smells a bit like tobacco.
I can't even imagine it. I honestly think this would turn me celibate.
But they don't, nobody eats it, do they? They put it in perfume.
Well, some people, back in the day, because it's so rare, it's not easy to find, yeah. And it's used in perfumes and stuff. It's super expensive because of its smell. You obviously, unless you're best friends with a sperm whale, you can't harvest it, can't grow it. So you need to wait until it's just bobbing on the water or washes up on a beach. And then you've got your ambergris. So people just luck out. In 2015, these dog walkers found a chunk that was about 1.1 kilograms and it sold for 11 grand.
Whoa.
Like, it's spenny.
Keep an eye out.
Where were they dog walking exactly?
Anglesey, I think.
Just asking for a friend.
Okay.
Some people did think it was an aphrodisiac and would eat parts of it. And in 2016, researchers found that it did actually boost testosterone levels and the frequency of erections in rats, in male rats. But in humans, it is very toxic. Do not eat it. It will not make your erection.
I was going to say, there's literally no way that's not going to make you ill.
It will definitely make you ill. But if you're a rat, it might help a little bit.
It's an interesting word as well, isn't it? Ambergris.
Mm-hmm. Ambergris means grey amber.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But amber, I guess, being like a semi-precious stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then gris is the grey bit.
Ugh, I feel very sick.
Should we move on? Yes. Fast forwarding to 20th century, we have the Caribbean, which is a hotbed for aphrodisiacs. Manny, you mentioned peanut punch in our peanut episode.
Oh, yeah.
Carrageenan.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sea moss.
Sea. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is used to... pep up a man's member. Also cow cod soup, which is pretty like on the nose. You basically make a soup from a bull's penis, and supposedly that will help your penis. It's a bit like what you were saying about
the your virility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you may have heard of mannish water, which is goat offal soup, and also often contains testicles from the goat. And supposedly, but I think it's more to do with the Scotch bonnet peppers making you go "Hoo!" and feeling, you know, excited and virile. But there's another myth in the Caribbean. There's a thing called bois bondé, which literally means erect wood in French. And it's meant to give you a priapism, which is where you have an like, uncontrollable erection. It's actually quite bad for you to have an erection for more than like an hour. So it sounds like a curse rather than a blessing. Anyway, there's supposedly people on the beach will sell you. And that comes from the bark of three specific trees. And in fact, there's also a myth that if you whack your member four times on a pawpaw tree, you'll have an everlasting erection, which again, I don't think I want. It's a cautionary tale, really. And also, they often cook male iguanas. You'll find iguana dishes in Central America, Caribbean, because they have two penises.
What?
Yeah.
What?
The males do, at least. Oh. They average out to one each, in fact.
So funny.
That led me on to modern day fetishes. So all of these supposed aphrodisiacs. I love that humans are so desperate to like enjoy sex more that they have tried to come up with these foodstuffs. And in the nature of just trying new things, I think we've discovered a lot of interesting foods. Like who thought to eat an oyster for the first time?
Oh, ambergris.
Or ambergris, that's so true. But they've never really been able to statistically say in a scientific experiment that this chemically makes you hornier or this foodstuff will make you more fertile. But I don't think that matters because of the placebo effect. I think if you eat something imagining it will make you feel good and then it does, then what's the harm in that? So I think it's wonderful that in today's society, we can look back on all the historical aphrodisiacs and then also use some of them as... Like, we're very fetish open these days.
Fetish facing.
Fetish forward.
That's it. Well done, Manny.
So all of that links to my cake. Brace yourselves. Cytophilia is the sexual pleasure from playing with food. For example, chocolate sauce over someone's body, whipped cream. So I found there's a specific fetishism called wet and messy fetishism, and it's commonly known as sploshing.
Yes, I've heard of sploshing.
Have you heard of sploshing?
Yeah.
I can see the appeal. I don't think I'm a sploshist myself.
Did you watch that Vice documentary on sploshing?
No, did you?
It's basically this dominatrix who was covering her clients in sticky stuff.
Yeah.
And it was all like textures and noises and like crunches and cracks and popples.
But all edible, like sploshing is all edible.
All edible. So she was using like honey, again, you said cream, that was a big one, and playing with how like the food stuck to your body and what it was like to move around and then like colours and smells that all went together.
The cake sitting is basically the Venn diagram between people who enjoy wet and messy fetishes and destruction fetishes. Because I think a lot of the time, the sexual appeal comes from someone has made this beautiful cake. They've sort of spent the time to ice it and dust it with icing sugar. And then someone comes along and squashes it and makes a mess. And yeah, I just think it's a fascinating example of how we've gone from aphrodisiacs being a kind of way to break through a taboo. If you had a cake sitting fetish, you might have been burnt at the stake at some points of history.
Yeah.
And now you can find a community online who enjoy the same things as you.
I mean, I've got to be honest, bread, dildo, cake sitting, not that far apart. They're pretty close together.
Just bread, dildos with extra steps.
It's the great British sex bake-off.
Okay, it's time for lunchbox number two, and this week that is Manu's.
Today I have bought an anti-aphrodisiac. I'm going to ruin the mood completely. This is actually a double anti-aphrodisiac, chocolate-dipped lettuce.
Wait, I thought chocolate was an aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
Well, as we've said, the way that we think and talk about particular foods can be very sexy, but a lot of that is going on in our heads. So that's imaginary placebo hype building with food. There has actually been a study that has shown chocolate might actually lower your sex drive. This is particularly in women because it is so good.
I gotta say, I agree. I'm so distracted by the chocolate.
Wow.
That I don't remember to have sex.
So don't bring your partner Valentine's chocolates.
Don't do that. So in 2021, there are a group of researchers that were looking into how chocolate affects your sex drive in different women.
Scientists are so randy.
And they found that women that ate more chocolate were actually less interested in sex. And this was even after they controlled for things like low mood, blood pressure, calorie intake in general, without looking at other dietary factors. And they suggested it was because chocolate plays such a big role in kind of boosting our levels of serotonin and dopamine because it's so enjoyable, particularly for women, whether that's like a nurture or nature thing, we're not sure, that it actually made them less interested in sex because they were getting so much satisfaction out of the chocolate.
So jumping straight to the orgasm without the foreplay, I guess.
Yeah, isn't that just eat some chocolate? But what was really interesting about the psychology of chocolate eating and aphrodisiacs is another researcher was saying, when you think about it in this way, the context of eating chocolate is so important because this kind of scientific chocolate probably doesn't make you feel sexy. And then if you're eating like a Twix on the bus somewhere random in London, like that's not a sexy chocolate.
Speak for yourself.
Also,
I love the way the bus vibrates if you sit at the back.
I think worth mentioning that in particular, chocolate is often used as a sort of like plaster when you're having your period because it's really like soothing, as you say, gets your dopamine, serotonin going, so you're feeling a little bit better when you're hormonally quite low. But I can that's not very sexy, that's very much like comfort.
It's a comfort food.
It's
just if you build enough kind of hype and the idea of sexiness around that's probably why it's become that kind of like aphrodisiac, that
the
sexy
placebo
food.
Effect it's all comfort. I think the placebo effect is super powerful
and valuable as well,
really valuable.
And then the lettuce, it's a historical anti-aphrodisiac. So Pythagoras actually called lettuce the plant of the eunuchs.
Savage. That is savage on lettuce.
And the 17th century herbalist and Dr. Nicholas Culpepper said if you juiced a lettuce, it could reduce bodily lust. So it's very much a kind of libido-killing not sexy. Say if you had problems with an overactive libido, you might give them lettuce.
It's interesting though, because I think lettuce, especially these lovely cupped leaves that you have given us today, dipping, as I like to do, lettuce in mayonnaise.
like a whole...
Anything with mayonnaise is going to get sexual.
A dip of lettuce in mayonnaise and then you eat that. That's sexy for me. Are you going to eat it?
Yeah, I was going to say.
I was going to ask if we can try it.
Of course.
How's it? Tastes like you'd expect.
Yeah, it's not. It's also.
I can see how that would kill the mood.
Well, you're welcome.
So, rocket was an aphrodisiac to the ancient Romans because that, like, tang and spice and peppery kick, which, you know, usually leads to people calling it an aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
Then later, medieval physicians, I suppose, would start the sort of concept of a balanced meal, not in terms of protein and carbohydrates, but in terms of like sexy foods and non-sexy foods, or like foods that heat you up and foods that cool you down. And they'd often eat anti-aphrodisiac lettuce with the rockets to kind of even it out so that you're sort of being tempered.
Smart. Yeah. Very smart. Another anti-aphrodisiac I wanted to talk about historically was coffee.
Okay.
So you remember we spoke about coffee houses before in our coffee episode?
I remember.
In the 17th century, in England, this is kind of like the boom of the coffee house. And by the 1660s, there are about 80 of them all over London. And there was a pamphlet published, which was called The Women's Petition Against Coffee. And they were basically very, very angry about this newfangled, abominable, heathenish liquor making their husbands impotent and effeminate. So it was basically a letter that these women had written that was like, we're not getting any because all of our husbands are out drinking coffee all the time.
They're all participating in the Enlightenment rather than coming and giving me a good seeing to.
Exactly.
Honey, come home. I can't. I'm busy inventing the Industrial Revolution.
Anyway, so this is a really famous pamphlet published in 1674. Today, historians think that it was probably more satirical or actually written in an attempt to quash dissent and political dissent.
Dissent quashing is another fetish I found.
Because basically all of the ideas that were coming out of coffee houses were quite revolutionary. Yeah, yeah. Like lots of educated people finally getting together in a space where you weren't drinking alcohol and drinking coffee instead. So a lot of very smart cookies. Charles II actually tried to ban coffee houses a year later. So it's more likely a kind of satirical trying to convince men not to go to these places where they're likely to become politically
It's tempting opposed. Them away from the coffee house by saying, look, your wives all want to have sex.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And even better, in 2023, so this is just looking at coffee more broadly, it was found that it's actually one of the things that we can eat and drink that is more likely to boost our libido. So it actually does make,
really?
It makes us hornier. So researchers found that if they gave women coffee and then played them erotic films, they were more likely to have increased vaginal pulses and like a higher pulse and genital arousal than the women who'd had placebo coffee.
Decaf.
So that's actually, that's pretty conclusive aphrodisiac.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's a drug. Like caffeine is a psychoactive drug, a bit like alcohol and all of these other chemicals we know affect our bodies in that way versus foods which kind of operate on a different plane. So I feel like it's unfair to compare coffee.
Fine. Yeah, okay. I see that. Could you not argue that alcohol is maybe one of the truest aphrodisiacs?
It's a strong argument. I think it's not so much an aphrodisiac as a disinhibitor. So you're more likely to go up to someone you fancy if your inhibitions are gone because you've had a few drinks. So I looked into beer goggles, which is the phenomenon whereby if you've imbibed alcohol, you find other people more attractive. And interestingly, they work both ways. So drunk people think they're more attractive and sober people also think drunk people are more attractive.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, isn't surely there's a tipping point where it's like sexier, sexier?
This is it. They're all J curves. So like the curve of attractiveness goes up initially and then it starts going down and down and down. Basically, tipsy people look attractive to sober people because our muscles relax when we drink and we just get a bit more smiley and confident. And that generally leads to positive results when they're surveying people about, you know, they'll show them a picture of someone who's had two drinks. But yeah, as you say, it's a J curve. Wasted people are not attractive.
That's not sexy.
And on the drunk people thinking they're more attractive, there's an amazing study with 83 Frenchmen and they got half of them drunk and the other half sober. And then they got a different half to believe they were drunk and then the other half to believe they were sober. So there were four categories. There were those who were sober and believed they were sober. There were those who were drunk and believed they were drunk. And then there were those who were drunk but believed they were sober. And then the fourth category were those who were sober but believed they were drunk. And then they got them to record a promo video for this new product into camera, and then they played it back to them. The ones that thought they were drunk rated themselves as more attractive, even if they weren't. So that's another example of the placebo effect. Yeah. Okay, it's time for our third and final lunchbox, and this week that comes from Rosie. What have you brought?
I bought a bowl of M&Ms, but only the green ones.
Oh, interesting. Ooh. Are they your fave?
They're the sexy ones.
Wait, what?
Okay, so M&Ms are one of the more anthropomorphized sweets in the chocolate sweets canon. The branding of M&Ms, I don't know if you've seen the M&M characters, but the green one, she is called Miss Green.
Okay.
And she's the first female M&M character.
Oh, of course they made the first one.
Well, trailblazer or deeply misogynistic, you decide. In the 90s, she's clearly supposed to be a sexy cartoon M&M. She's curvaceous. She's a round M&M.
Curvaceous.
And she's wearing sexy white boots.
She's got heels
and
like
big eyelashes.
Yeah, mascara.
Importantly, the eyelashes
lips.
And mascara. And
well,
yeah, and big lips. She's a sexy lady. Why did Mars, who own M&Ms, decide to make such a strange marketing decision? The reason why is because there was this rumor in the 70s and 80s spreading around American college campuses.
Okay.
Perhaps fueled by psychotropic drugs, who's to say? And the rumor was that the green dye in green M&Ms was an aphrodisiac. Basically something that would increase sexual desire and kind of get you going a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's completely false.
Okay.
All the ingredients in all M&Ms are the same. They have obviously different food colorings, but for some reason, these students in the 70s and 80s were convinced that getting a green M&M meant that you were going to be like really randy.
Yeah. It's just not a sexy color, though.
I'm going to talk about that.
They could have picked the red one.
Okay.
But Mars, who own M&Ms, really leaned into this in the 90s when they decided to do a big rebrand. And the green one, they made sexy because of this theory that they were actually sexy. Arguably a baffling decision to make a sexy M&M at all.
Yeah, that's so true.
To make any of them humanoids.
Yeah.
And then even more baffling was the wild success of this. 40 years later, there are places like Leicester Square where there is an M&M world where there are like six floors of M&M merchandise. So also one worth noting that in 2022, her boots were replaced by more effortless sneakers.
Oh, so she doesn't wear high heels anymore.
She doesn't wear heels anymore. Okay. She's become a bit of a girl next door vibe.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I'm going to talk now a bit more broadly. There are different things to take into consideration when you eat. It's not just one sense that is being used when you eat. In fact, all five of your senses are being used.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What I'm going to talk about is the study of neurogastronomy. Have you ever heard of this? It's the scientific endeavor to understand interactions between our brain, food, and eating. And essentially, the belief is that food flavors are created in the brain as a product of information from all of our senses, not actually just olfactory things on your tongue. Exactly.
So this would be very similar to like the kind of Charles Spence-y gastrophysics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we always say things like, you know, eating food off a red plate makes you eat more. And it's kind of the
like multisensory
eating, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Because it's not just about plonking a square of dark chocolate in front of someone being like, here, give yourself an erection. It's actually a lot more about situation.
Wait, where did you find out about this study?
In my head, I'm thinking the M&S adverts, which we've spoken quite a lot about.
Yeah,
the spoon going into
sexy spooning. Animation. So the neurogastronomy movement was first conceived in 2006 by a man called Gordon M. Shepherd, new friend of the pod. Welcome, Gordon. So importantly, it's not just scientists who are looking at this stuff. It's actually chefs as well who are contributing to this new area of science, really. Mm-hmm. It is essentially a multidisciplinary study, right? Mm-hmm. What they've already found loads of evidence on is that mood and memory and setting can alter how we experience food. All of our Valentine's meals that we talked about, like, how's that going to come across to us? You know, it might be the most mid chicken stew, Korean chicken stew that me and Tom ever made in our lives, but because we're making it together, looking at each other over the pot as we do it, it's romantic. It's sexy.
It's literally steamy as well.
And it's a story. My obsession with terroir is because there's a story behind it, and humans love stories. Mm-hmm. And they love to be able to say, look, I got this wine that was sort of grown in the shadow of the volcano in Mount Etna. I bet it tastes different. And like, yeah, again, in the scientific trial, I might not be able to tell the difference.
But I
really buy into this stuff.
And so there's a few sort of like interesting examples where neurogastronomy is already really obviously at play. One of them is particularly with the sweet taste, has been actually found to determine how much people like you.
Ooh.
Basically, researchers have found that eating sweets and being sweet are highly correlated.
Oh, wow.
Strangers who were described as liking honey were rated as friendlier people.
Oh, so if people think you have a sweet tooth, they're more likely to think that you're nice.
You're nice, exactly. People who were liking honey were rated as friendlier, more cooperative, and more compassionate than strangers who had perhaps said that they liked different things like grapefruit. Bitter taste equals bitter person. Another thing I was thinking about when I was looking at this is spicy food. Actually, an aphrodisiac we haven't covered very much.
But it is
rumoured to be an aphrodisiac. Yeah. And actually, when you think about why, chili and the spicy, you know, olfactory experience is a kind of pain, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pain releases endorphins. Endorphins are the body's opioids.
Mm.
And they are what make you aroused, almost, or like brightened. It's worth noting that humans are the only creatures that eat hot food, eat spicy food, like spice.
Because there are a lot of animals that eat it, but they can't taste it.
Yeah.
This is, I'm getting, when people have bad taste in partners and they're like, oh, you want a bit of danger and a bit of like, oh,
well, it's sadomasochistic,
people that like really really hot food, I'm like, why do you want to hurt yourself and not be able to
it's
taste
the rush
anything?
Yeah, but then what would you say to someone who is literally into S&M? That's what they like. Pain arouses them.
This is not just an S&M curry.
Well, also, I think one of the more important parts of neurogastronomy is the use of sight in food. Mm. So what you see when you eat it. Red food colouring makes food taste sweeter to people.
Okay. Mm.
The presence of red food colouring, they inherently think of strawberries, they think of sweets, they think of nice things. Even if it doesn't, in a blind tasting, tasting.
Makes sense. Evolutionarily, red things tend to signal ripeness and sweetness, which is why animals are really good at seeing.
And actually, this is one of the confusing things about the green M&M, is that green is actually inherently a sour colour flavour, as it were.
Yeah, I noticed actually fast food is often branded with red colouring because it makes us hungrier for the first part. And also raises our intense feelings so that we feel like we have to make a quick decision and therefore make an impulsive decision and therefore go into McDonald's when you're actually
that's kind of like the alarm.
Yeah, exactly.
All this to say, is the placebo effect more powerful than we think because of neurogastronomical response? Like, we respond more ways than just with the chemicals that might or might not be present in our food. So sure, chocolate isn't going to actually make you more virile, but you might feel more virile because you know that chocolate is rumoured to be something that makes you more virile.
And does it matter?
And does it matter?
If the placebo effect works, Why yuck that yum?
Why yuck that yum? Anyway, I hope that was an enjoyable detour into neurogastronomy. And maybe something to think about next time you're eating something you really love. Like, why do I love this? What are the multiple reasons why this is so comforting, or this is so sexy, or this is so delicious? Is it because you ate it once in a sexy place or did a sexy thing afterwards?
Oh, humans are weird.
Okay, so that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any parting recommendations for Valentine's week this week?
Actually, I'm going to recommend a film called The Taste of Things. Oh. It's a French film. The whole thing is one big aphrodisiac, in my opinion.
The best film.
It is spectacular food cinematography. If anyone out there was wanting to watch a film this Valentine's that's like really, really sexy, beautiful food, that's the film I'd recommend.
So that's it from us. I do have a very happy Valentine's week, however you celebrate, even if it's with a red dildo.
Oh my God.
I will see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, Rosie McKean, and me, Jack Chambers. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.